Welcome to What's Left, a weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Andy Lipson, this is Eduardo Barca, and we have a special guest today, Natalie, who's also a teacher at UESF. And the reason I'm doing the introduction today is Natalie is a friend of Eduardo's, and Eduardo's going to let us know more about Natalie, and then actually today's episode is really going to be about Natalie. She's a fellow socialist, a fellow teacher.
Yes, thank you. And we are, I'm really excited today because on today's show, Natalie Risi, she and I know each other for a while now, but she's very special and dear to my heart. We will discuss, Natalie Risi, I'm just going to introduce, she's a socialist and active organizer of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, which is the PSL. And she's a writing contributor for the Liberation newspaper of the PSL. She's a former classroom teacher, now librarian, and union representative of the United Educators of San Francisco, UESF, for the San Francisco Unified School District. She's not only that, she's also the editor of the magazine Breaking the Chains, former Peace and Freedom Party candidate for California Commission of Insurance in 2014 and 2018. And she's an awesome mother of two beautiful children. And a wonderful baker. welcome, Natalie.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I just mentioned that you're an editor of Breaking the Chains. I've mentioned that you're an organizer for the PSL. I've mentioned that you are a mother of two. I've mentioned that you are not only that, but you're also a writing contributor to the Liberation News. And you were a former candidate in 2014 and 2018. ¿Cómo le haces? How do you do it all?
That's a good question. I also sleep. I think that it's... All those things you mentioned are all... I mean, a lot of them are because I'm an organizer with the Party for Socialism and Liberation. So the magazine is a project of the party. I ran on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket, but... as a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. And I think the reason that I, like many members, are so active is because the struggle is so important. Mm. And, you know, if you don't have the struggle, then you're just sort of seeing what happens every single day in this society, and you know there's something wrong with it, and you're not doing anything to change it. So, yeah, sometimes it's not easy, especially having two kids. It's not easy to kind of keep that level of activity up, but you just, I always ask myself, like, if I didn't do this, then what would I be doing? Right? Because we have to change what's happening. Like, you can't live, especially in this city, like in this city where, you know, where we teach, I've taught in the Mission for many, many years. I teach now in Noe Valley, but my kids come from the Mission. They come from the Bayview. They come from the Excelsior, all these places in the city where people are being driven out. Where you're not able to live anymore. And I think that keeps you going. So you have to do it. Because, you know, it's sort of, otherwise then I don't know what I would do. I know that doesn't sound like that inspiring, but it is kind of true in a lot of ways. And I think it's also, now that I have kids, it's become more important. Because I feel like when you have kids, you do kind of feel like, okay, they're so young and you want to protect them in so many ways, but you know, at this point there's not going to be an earth if we allow capitalism to continue in the way that it's continuing. And so I think that's very inspiring, and you make time in your day. And I get up earlier than everyone I know. I don't go to bed later than everyone I know. I mean, I go to bed at a decent hour, but I do get up earlier because you need to, and you need to do the organizing and make it happen. And you find a way.
So I guess then, tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? Where did you, how did you get involved in activism? What was your upbringing like? Because you said that you wouldn't know what to do otherwise, right?
Yeah.
So what about yourself that you can tell us that led you to this path?
I'm not sure if it had a whole lot to do with my upbringing. I mean, I wasn't brought up in a particularly... I was brought up in a political family, but not a particularly progressive family. We're not a family of activists or anything like that. Mm. My first protest was the battle...
Were you raised here in the Bay Area?
Yeah, I was raised in Redwood City. Okay. We moved there from Boston when I was little. The Battle of Seattle was my first protest ever in my life.
The WTO.
Yeah, so Yeah, it was 1999, if I remember correctly. 1999, I was 18 years old. I was living in Tacoma, Washington, and there were protests planned against the World Trade Organization in the midst of what I didn't know at the time, but what was this anti-globalization movement that was, you know, you would pay attention to it, you hear about it, but you weren't entirely sure what it was. And so I was, you know, doing like a, I think I was doing like a food bank with some anarchists. Like that's, I just kind of fallen into it at my school. And we, and one of the economics professors helped us all get a bus and took us up there. And we joined a union protest. And it was huge. It was like this gigantic rally. It took a whole football field. It was all these workers. They left the football field and marched towards where the WTO were meeting. They were having these meetings. And we ran into the anarchist protests. And there were things on fire. And, you know, like, it was just this, like, sort of amazing coming together of, you know, at the time I was just overwhelmed. It was like, there are things on fire. There are police shooting rubber bullets at us. There's unionists. They're all sort of talking about the same thing in different ways. And, you know, the county ran out of rubber bullets and tear gas in a number of hours. I think it was like before the day was out. People, then we were doing jail solidarity. You know, it's just like it just kept going. And I think just being brought into that, having some political knowledge, but not a whole lot of development, but being on the street and seeing what people were fighting for was just incredible. It sort of, you know, and I think you're being raised the way I was, I did see things and you think about them, but you're not like directed toward a particular ideology or anything like that. You just sort of know, okay, well, there are things wrong. But then when you see people actually organizing around them, then you start to wonder, okay, what's really happening? Like what? And that was, so then I was an anarchist. I mean, that's what you did in 1999 at 18 years old. You were an anarchist. Yeah, I mean, they were leading the movement. I think, you know, it was kind of, it was exciting. It was rebellious. So, like, they were calling out all these things that were wrong. And as a young person and someone new to the movement, I couldn't see the pitfalls in it.
And it was working because it actually shut down the WTO operations.
Right.
So it worked.
Yeah. Totally. The globalization movement. And it became very popular. I mean, it was shifting popular consciousness, you know, people were. So that's how I sort of started being political. And so then I started reading anarchists and thinking about them and just sort of taking it all in, you know, and I was very proud to be an anarchist. And
did you consider yourself at that point like a revolutionary, like capitalism's got to go?
Definitely. I mean, I think that part, that piece of anarchism was what really appealed to me, was like, there's something fundamentally wrong with this system. And, and that's, you know, and I think that's some ways in which the anarchists have dovetailed with the socialists. And, you know, and there's a relationship in the history of those two movements in a lot of ways. And I didn't really comprehend the other things, you know. And then I had to quit school because of a bunch of family stuff. And I ended up back here in the Bay Area. I was living with my family and I met socialists. And it was 2001 or 2000, and you know, it was, the anarchists here were not as inspiring.
What are you talking about? We have Berkeley here.
I, to be entirely honest, I don't think I've ever put this story out on the internet either. But like, they weren't.
We'll get it here first.
I was a very shy young person. I tried to go to meetings. I couldn't figure out what was happening. I didn't know. And I met. I met Richard Becker, and he was like, come, do things with us, poster, do this, get involved.
Who is Richard Becker?
Oh, sorry. Richard Becker is a member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. He's also the regional coordinator for the ANSWER Coalition, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism. But this is before ANSWER even existed. He was very active in the Bay Area and had been. So I met him, and he invited me in, and everyone there was super welcoming. And I was nannying, I was sort of going to City College, I wasn't doing a lot, and they just sort of brought me in and were like, intern, learn how to do things. And I think that's when I started really becoming an organizer. Like, I hadn't just attended protests or read stuff, it was like, how do you actually organize a protest? And the first one was at Bohemian Grove in Sonoma County, north of here.
Where rich people meet and do crazy stuff.
Right, and rich white men.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's what happens. And it's secret, No one's allowed in unless they're invited. It's horrendous. They have these political and economic discussions and decision making amongst all this like sort of fraternal order horrible
and possibly
activities.
Jeffrey Epstein like craziness.
Really awful.
Oh,
it's a really awful place.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we that was the first protest I sort of helped organize a bus from San Francisco to go up there to rally, and then there was a march. It's in the woods, like in the woods.
Wow.
Like the rallying point was right next to the Russian River in Guerinville. And then you marched across and into the woods and held a protest. But it was a true learning experience to learn how to like talk to people, bring them in, get them bus tickets, make placards, make banners. I mean, all these things that, you know, that now many, many years later, I think of as sort of commonplace to organizing, but to me was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Like I didn't know how to do any of it.
Wow.
And so that was sort of the beginning. And then, I was in D.C. when September 11th happened, and the anti-globalization movement completely collapsed. And that was where the anarchists were the weakest, because they consensed not to do anything in the midst of what you could see was war and building racism, like immediately. And that's where the Answer Coalition comes out of, is a coalition of anti-imperialist forces at that time that came together as the leadership of the anti-globalization movement sort of collapsed. The Answer was building for a protest. And we had our first protest on September 25th, 2001. And it was a big deal to have that protest. And it really was just about not going to war and ending the racist attacks that were happening, particularly on Arabs and Muslims, but they were generalized. I mean, it was such a different climate in some ways. I mean, there are some things that you can see that are similar, like the way that immigrants are being attacked right now, there's a similarity. But when those attacks happened in September 11th, anyone who spoke out against the war, against race, I mean, we got spit on. Like, you would just be flyering and people would spit on you. They would call up the office and rant and rail about all sorts of things. It was like the climate was so uber patriotic. And then there was all this, they were rounding up Muslim men. So if you were a resident here, if you had any sort of, you weren't a citizen, you had to go and sign in at your local, it wasn't ICE at the time, it was Department of Homeland Security.
Might have been INS at the time.
That's what it was. And you had to register, and if you had anything wrong, they detained you. And it was just this like really intense climate. And so the protest was really about not going to war, which you could also tell they were trying to go to war, and ending the attacks, the racist attacks. And that was, I think that's how I really got started.
So you are a socialist, and that's when you really identified yourself as a socialist then?
Yeah.
What marked your transition from anarchism to socialism? When did you say, I'm leaving this set of revolutionary politics and taking up this? How did that go politically or organizationally? What led to that transition? And how would you characterize the difference politically for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I just described were the events in that transition, because it started with really as a young person being brought in and taught things, and that was like sort of materially important.
Yeah.
Was like, I didn't know how to be an organizer, and to be welcomed in and taught was really critical.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I just sort of would have drifted into thinking about politics,
right.
But like that, and that happened with people who openly identified as socialists themselves.
Yeah.
And so that was big for me. Like, I couldn't find that in the places I was looking, in the political spaces I thought I identified with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would go to the anarchists, and I had one really funny interaction. I don't even know who it was or what organization, so I'm not trying to knock anyone. I just remember in my head going and then being like, well, why are you organizing with them? They don't let you make decisions. You just poster. I was like, yes, that is why I'm doing that. I don't want to make decisions, I want a poster. You know, like, that's what I want to be able to do, because I don't feel ready to make decisions. I feel there's a whole political world out there I don't fully understand. I just want to be, like, active. So that was, like, the beginning. And then I went to those meetings in D.C. when the anarchists consensed not to do anything. I was after.
Oh, okay, right.
I was still thought I was an anarchist. And so I went to those meetings. And
after 9/11 and the war started.
Like,
the war
2 days
forward,
after 9/11. And I just sat there and was like, what?
Right.
Like, how is this happening? I don't get it. And so it was that was like the political moment. And then I did a lot more study, right? And I started to really read more about who were socialists, who were communists, who were the anarchists. And so I think after the sort of material changes and the organizational like effects that had on me, then it was more of a political shift. Like, okay, all those things, like when your family grills you on why you're an anarchist and what's going to happen after the revolution that you can't answer, it's because they don't have the answer. And for me, it was like, this actually like lays out what is an answer and how, and it seemed more realistic at that point.
Yeah.
So I think that was the, yeah.
Can you say some of the things that you feel like that you read that were most central to forming your core ideas? And what would you describe as the core ideas you now are saying, this is what makes me a revolutionary, this is what makes me a socialist and a Marxist?
Yeah. Sure. It's a long list.
Maybe you can pare it down.
Yeah, but, I'm thinking it through. I mean, I think some of the central thing, I mean, Lenin, I would say, reading a lot of Lenin and then reading it in a collective group, because the first time I read things like State and Revolution, the first time I read imperialism, the first time I read What is to Be Done, they made some sense, but they were hard. Mm-hmm. It was not easy. So I feel like doing that in a group of people and getting to talk about it and hear it. I also, I mean, the very first chapter of Capital was huge. But the same thing, it was studying it. I tried to read it, it made no sense, but like
it's
studying
hard.
It
yeah.
with a group of people and talking it out, I would say those things were definitely, and then there was a set of books, like narrative history, that when I was younger were so much easier to read. So like Red Star Over China, I thought that would, Red Star Over China was written about the Russian Revolution from a British journalist, but he had access. So he sat down with Mao many, many times. But it's just, it's a big book.
Is it Revolution in Russia or China?
Red Star Over China.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't Russia.
No,
okay.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Red Star Over China. But 10 Days That Shook the World was another one that, you know,
yeah,
it kind of your narrative, you read it.
Right.
So those were great. I read like Black Bolshevik. That I thought was like a really incredible way to access U.S. history and the Soviet Union and like think about it. I remember reading that. And then a whole lot of like Latin American stuff, because I got kind of involved in the Latin America solidarity movement simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Eduardo Galeano and the history of Che and Cuba, like just kind of reading that sort of, I think those would be the major books or literature that started to make a lot more sense, you know, whereas like I had been reading Emma Goldman or Bakunin, and they didn't have the same meat to them, where they really broke things down and explained, like the way Lenin breaks down State and Revolution. It's like, kind of amazing once you get to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
are you a Leninist or a Marxist?
Those names.
A Maoist?
There's so many of them, aren't there?
What are you?
Aren't they?
Yeah. How do you, like, you know, because some people do identify.
Yeah.
Some people are strictly, I'm a Marxist. We had someone, a socialist, come here who's been a socialist since the 60s. And he says, I'm a Maoist. Like,
right.
And so what, I mean, what would you say in the web of all that? Would you say
in the web of all that? I would say I avoid all of that. And this is why I would say it.
Yeah.
I mean, partially, okay, so I'm in, I think this is the way I want to say it. I'm in the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I mean, I think as an individual, I don't tell these stories very often because it's also important, like, not just to be the individual, right? It's like, I do think it's important to be an organization and be doing the work, you know? And a lot of those names, people use them because of what they've read or what they, you know? And I think for people, I would say, like, especially younger than me, those names all come from, like, a historical moment. Like, you were a Maoist because you identified with a tendency in a very vibrant communist socialist movement where there actually was, you know, like a socialist camp.
Mm.
And the socialist camp itself was divided. And so the Maoists were with one tendency in a socialist camp, right? And the Marxist-Leninists were in another. And then in the Trotskyists were in another. And I think that history is vibrant and important and real.
Mm.
But it's also like, what history are we making right now? We're not in a world with a socialist camp. Like, we're in a world that the capitalists dominate, and they're our enemy, and they're who we're fighting, and the socialists need to, as best they can, there are political differences, and I completely agree that, like, you can't always just, like, smooth those over, but, like, people who are becoming socialists now are becoming socialists because they hear Bernie Sanders say he's a socialist, They're not becoming socialists because, you know, there's a Sino-Soviet split and they're siding with the Chinese over the Soviet Union, which was a whole mess anyway. But like, so I do think those names to some degree have less impact in the movement today, to some degree. I'm not saying people don't hold dear to them, but I do feel like I wouldn't call myself any of those personally, but I think also, you know, I'm representing the party, and as you do when you're a socialist in the party, and, you know, I think that we want to analyze the world the way it is, using Marx and Lenin as a science. That's really what Lenin did. Like, Lenin applied Marxism to what was happening on the ground, and what was happening on the ground was actually a revolution. And the revolution was successful because the Bolsheviks were able to really turn towards it. And he really applied that understanding, you know, and in a way that wasn't super popular at the time. And I think that's what we have to be able to do. We have to be able to say, what is happening in our current political context, and how can we best fight against the system itself so we can replace it with something that we need? Because I think that's why we're socialists. Like, we need socialism. We need the contradictions of capitalism to be resolved. We need people to have housing and jobs and education and healthcare, and capitalism isn't going to provide that.
Here is a question from one of our listeners. They knew you were coming, so they posed a question. JM asks, but wouldn't everyone have to be altruistic for socialism to work? I don't see how people will contribute to society if there isn't a motivation for incentive to work and participate for society's general good. Why will people work if they don't have to? She's talking
That's
about
a really good question.
Under a socialist
right.
democracy. That's it, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's because, okay, so people assume because right now we don't want to work unless we have to, right? I mean, that's the assumption. Right now you're like, oh, I got to get up for work, and it sucks, and you just do it. You get up, you go to work, because otherwise you wouldn't survive. We have to think about work under socialism in a completely different way. It's more like, I think most people actually have work they do all the time because they care. So they care for their parents because they care. They care for their kids because they care. They go out and they do things. People volunteer all the time. They donate all the time. They overwhelm people with their donations. When a catastrophe happens, that people are overwhelmed by the offers of help, of money, because people are fundamentally actually altruistic, like they are. It's the way society is organized that dampens that, that destroys it. And I think that's, so socialism, work under socialism is different. It will be organized differently. It will be, you know, instead of going to a workplace, like, I like to think about how we would radicalize schools under socialism. We don't need principals. You know, like, some of them are good, some of them are terrible, but you don't actually need them. Like, teachers, secretaries, janitors, we all know how to run the school. But in this society, you need a boss to keep everyone going. In a different form of society, you don't. You would have teacher leaders, or you would have a committee that runs the school that's got a parent on it, and maybe even a student when we get more mature in our socialist society and our students are, you know, they're better. Like, if you look at the students in Cuba, they're extremely well trained. They have this incredible education that, with a very lack of resources, includes the arts, includes high academics, includes all of these things, and also social training about how you care for each other and how you interact and how you support each other. So it's just a different, I think, method of organizing it, that you're not stuck in a situation where you just have all these people who are like, well, I'm not going to go to work because I just don't want to. You have some, and you will have some. They'll exist. It'll be part of the society, but the overwhelming majority of people don't operate like that. In fact, they go to horrible jobs every day to keep their families afloat. They suffer in order to make other people's lives better. It's not necessarily always just for themselves, you know? So I think that it's just about sort of changing the way we think about those things. But one of my favorite examples, actually, of the way people take care of each other is the Hurricane Katrina. If you look at what happened during Hurricane Katrina, when that entire area was just left to fend for itself, people made each other boats. They risked their lives going back to ferry out not just people, but like pets. Like, they were putting dogs and cats and children. And, you know, they came together as a community in some of the most horrific situations where they were left with no resources. And then, you know, because we're in a really messed up society, they were depicted as looters and all these things. But that's not what was going on. What was really going on was the government, the state, failed them. And they made do, and they did it not by, like, fighting each other or pushing each other off of things. They made do by coming together. And imagine that in a situation with resources, where you actually have what you need. And you come together, and you provide for each other. And I don't know. I don't know if that was a sufficient answer, but my feeling is that it would be very different. It wouldn't be what we have right now.
And
I hope JM liked that answer.
Natalie, you mentioned right now socialism is on the rise because of Bernie Sanders. I guess you said right now that it doesn't, those names you said, the Maoists and Stalinists and all these, really, it really isn't, you stay away from going into whether we should be in those camps or not. But there is a distinction between a democratic socialist, what Bernie Sanders is labeling himself as, and running as a candidate in the Democratic Party, and socialists, real socialists, right? Would you not say that it's still important to defer and draw a line between a democratic socialist that is working within the Democratic Party and socialists that are trying to do outside of the Democratic Party?
I mean, I think that's also... Okay, so that question is important because I don't think socialism is necessarily becoming more popular just because of Bernie Sanders. I think Bernie Sanders calling himself a socialist was very unique in the U.S. political arena. You know, we don't often hear, okay, we never hear, until Bernie Sanders in the last in the 2016 campaign, anyone admitting to being a socialist. And so I think that combined with his sort of very popular economic social programs and ideas, which have a socialist bent, right? So the idea that everyone should have health care, the idea that everyone should have college and education, you know, that people shouldn't make enormous amounts of money. But he'll admit he, like, looks more to the socialists of Europe, right? Which are democratic social, they're capitalist countries. They have extremely large welfare states. They have programs that, you know, could be minimally called socialist, but that's because of the gains of the working class in those places where it was very organized. You know, so he even wouldn't admit to being like a, so like as you said, a real socialist. Although I think we should also, it's hard when you start talking about who's a real socialist, right? But I do think because Bernie Sanders did that, the word socialism got a lot of credibility and a lot of interest, and people started looking at it. But I think the real reason that people are so open to socialism is a combination of factors, which includes how desperate people are. Just how, I mean, how little your wages are worth, how little a future you feel you have when you're racking up tens of thousands of dollars in debt just to go to school and then get out of school and you don't have a job. And, you know, like, we're teachers here. Teachers are leaving. Teachers who have union jobs are being driven out of the city, even though, yeah?
Can I pause you for
a
second?
Yeah, of course.
You got it.
Okay, so one of the factors is really, you know, the desperation people feel living under capitalism. And so any alternative is interesting. I mean, they look at it, they want to think about it. And I think, you know, the other factor that's really important is the amount of time since the Soviet Union, the socialist camp was overthrown in the late 80s, early 90s. People have grown up without the sort of virulent anti-communism that was constant in U.S. society against the Soviet Union. Again, and it still exists. There's still a huge legacy of anti-communism, but it's more muted. And I do think that younger people have grown up without that heavy influence. They don't feel the same way, say, my parents do when you talk about communists or socialists. They're like, oh, no. We don't touch that. Communists lose their jobs, they go to jail, they're evil. Exactly, Red Scare. There's none of that. And so the word socialism doesn't have the same sort of like scary impact on them. It's just socialism. What is it? Let's find out. Let's look it up. Let's figure out, you know, and they're socialists. And then what is a socialist? Well, I like this guy. Bernie Sanders is saying we should have health care, we should have college education, we should have these things. Okay, well, I'm going to keep looking into that, right? And so I think it's very important that socialism is sort of on the rise. And you can feel it. Mm-hmm. Like, you can just, on the street, feel it. It's different than it was 15 years ago. It's the way people respond to you when you say, you know, I'm a socialist. Like, I've been an open socialist at work since I started teaching. which I think was 13 years ago, but I'm never sure. And you used to say, yeah, I'm a socialist, I'm a communist. People would laugh at you. Now you say it, they're like, really? You know, like, they think about it.
You've seen the shift.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I think that's really, that's important. And it's important to recognize that, and that that opening is important. And I also think, just in regards to Bernie Sanders, I mean, we could talk about it more, but I don't see him as being part of the Democratic establishment at all. Mm. I do think that he's very much, you know, aligned with the Democratic Party. He made choices after the 2016 election not to push it anymore, not to rock the boat. But they see him as a threat, and they undermined him. The Democratic Party establishment made sure Bernie Sanders was not the candidate, and they went with Hillary Clinton. They went with a warmongering, racist, unpopular candidate instead of the one that could have faced off against Trump's xenophobia and sexism and hatred, right? And they did that because the program of Bernie Sanders is not the program of the Democratic Party establishment. Mm-hmm. That's not what they want to adopt, and they're fighting tooth and nail against it. And I think that's a very important dynamic. And I think as we move into the 2020 elections, that dynamic is really important. Like, you know, the Democratic Party establishment still seems to be very focused on Biden, who's a horrendous candidate. He's the Democratic Party establishment. Nancy Pelosi. I mean, these characters are awful. They don't like regular people. They constantly want to go to war. They think Russia's the big bad enemy when the Trump administration's the one sort of fighting against everyone. So I think we are in sort of an interesting time. There's a lot of openness about socialism. And those of us who are advocating for revolution, advocating for the power in the hands of the working class, have an opportunity to explain that and to popularize it in a way that I don't think we had the opportunity to 10 years ago. Mm.
So what would you say about the idea of, like, a lot of socialists are joining DSA, mm-hmm. Or joining DSA and saying, oh, I'm trying to radicalize it. And what would you say about that project? Is that something that you, as a member of PSL, or is that something you would encourage people to do?
To join the DSA? No.
Well, but or to not join DSA, but be part of a coalition, say a socialist coalition, because there are people who are, like, there are radical groups within DSA who say, oh,
yeah.
I'm not a democratic socialist, but I am part of these group of socialists who are working underneath this Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez umbrella.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think that the attempts to work within the system to change the system have failed. I don't think that that is an opportunity for us as socialists necessarily. I do think that there are moments where we can sort of ally even with much less radical socialists or, you know, work. Some of the things that are happening with the, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Tlaib, mm-hmm. and you know, those sort of few very progressive members that got elected, I think they're very exciting and inspiring for people, but they're also not challenging the system or the status quo to the point that I think we need to be at. I do think we're at a crisis. I do think socialism offers a solution to the crises that we're facing that you're not going to be able to achieve just through focusing on the elections. And I do think we understand that the elections serve as a tool to take that energy and focus it in a way that isn't very effective. It's very, very hard to run a truly socialist campaign in this country because of the way the electoral system is set up. It's really a two-party system. It's for the two main capitalist parties. And I think that's why sometimes people do think, okay, we got to do it this way. We have to do it this way, right? I mean, you feel like there's no alternative. There's no other choice. And I do think that there are moments when maybe we could, you know, join together in a protest. That'd be great. And I do think that a lot of people who have joined the DSA really do believe in the possibility for socialism. But I think the organization itself is fundamentally different in that it doesn't fully believe that you can't have a revolution in the United States. And I think that's necessary. It is possible to have a revolution in the United States. It is possible to change the system in the United States. It just seems impossible because the state in this country is so powerful. It's the center of imperialism. So it's very hard to think about overcoming that. But I do think we do need to be committed to that, and I think we can convince people of the necessity of it. And I do think we have to also be focused on all the things that are happening outside the sort of horrible electoral arena. Like, we have to be there, but we also have to be with all the teachers that have been striking. We have to be with, you know, the Me Too movement and all of the different, like, street movements and organizations that could really sort of find that place where the struggle could break out. And that's, you know, that's what we don't know, is when is that going to happen, but I do think it's a possibility. So it's a challenge. And I don't think joining the DSA is the answer.
Or voting for Bernie Sanders.
I mean, I think that's a question we're going to have to deal with. It's a question we're going to have to wrestle with in the 2020 elections. Like, I don't think we can say right now exactly what we would do, right?
Are you going to vote for Bernie Sanders?
Right now?
Would you vote for Bernie Sanders?
At this moment, no. I would not at this moment. I'm also not in the Democratic Party, so I don't have to vote for anyone until the 2020 elections are so far off.
Yeah.
Jeez, we're just working through our kids.
Oh, it's coming, though.
But I do think that in so much as Bernie Sanders threatens the Democratic Party's hold on the movement, I do think that's progressive. And I do think if they can continue to do that, that's great. I think the Democratic Party has acted as a brake, an absolute brake on the movement in this country. And what I mean by that is the Democratic Party says that it speaks for Black, Latino people, that it speaks for oppressed people, that it speaks for women, that it speaks for working people. It says this all the time, and it never actually acts in their interests, ever. And so time and time again, you know, they have betrayed the working class and oppressed people in this country. Yet every time an election comes, you're supposed to vote for a Democrat, right? Every 4 years, you got to vote for the Democrat. And, you know, in the last election, I even remember, like, a friend, I was postering, because we ran Gloria LaRiva for president in the 2016 election, and I was postering for her campaign in the Castro. And a friend of mine, who I didn't know was there when I was postering, just started yelling at me about how I was going to let Trump win. And I mean, that's the tenor of the electoral system in this country, is that if you vote your conscience, if you vote for a socialist, if you vote for something you believe in, you're losing it for the rest of us because the most racist, xenophobic, horrific character might win. I mean, that's the level of the electoral debate in this country. So, anything that can break that up is good.
And you see that Bernie Sanders is possibly playing that role?
I think it did in the 2016 elections. I think it's yet to be seen in the 2020 elections. I mean, I'm following them as closely as I can with all the things we listed.
Yeah.
But you watch the debates, and I think people respond very strongly to both Sanders and Warren's more progressive platforms. Mm-hmm. I think that's important that it's out there. I still think socialists should run their own candidates. I still think, you know, when socialist candidates are out there, we should vote for socialist candidates, and we should support those campaigns. I think that's critical.
I was voting for Bernie Sanders then, and you told me not to.
That's because we were voting for Gloria Relief.
Well, fortunately, you came.
And I'm not saying I'm going to tell you to vote in 2020 either. I'm just saying I think that the way we approach them is not the view of, like, of what's imposed on us. Mm-hmm. The view of the elections is, what do they fundamentally serve as? They are a tool of the ruling class, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're not going to be forced into voting for anyone unless that person strengthens the struggle against that class. Mm-hmm. I don't think Bernie Sanders is that person right now, but he might be. He could be.
Even if he is a Democrat or running as a Democrat?
Yeah, I think there have been, I'm trying to think of, like, good historical examples. I think there's been a few historical examples where people running as Democrats really are running from a place where they're coming from the movement, right?
But they've never been elected.
They were before, they've never been elected.
Oh, I see.
They would be before my time, I think, too. I would be, like, remembering things I'd
people
read about.
People got excited about the Rainbow Coalition.
Exactly, Jesse Jackson and the Rainbow Coalition. I mean, I was very young, so I wasn't around for that. But that, you know, what I've read about that was something like that, where Jesse Jackson put together a coalition that was really confronting racism, really confronting these deep, deep ills in the society, but as a Democrat. Mm. And I think in that case, when it's coming, it has that sort of ability to break open more movement and open more struggle and push the struggle forward. Yeah, I think. But in general, I vote for social. You know, I've always voted for the socialists.
So you've had, I didn't know this, you've had some experience, electoral experience yourself.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that and how you tried to do it? You were a socialist then, you were a PSL. Can you say something about how you felt, what you did right in that campaign, or say about the campaign,
but
also lessons you learned about, okay, I would do it differently this time, or something like that?
That's a good question. So I ran twice, I always forget the years, 2018 and 2014, on the Peace and Freedom Party. And I think Peace and Freedom Party is really important. I think if you're a socialist in the state of California, you should register Peace and Freedom Party. Mm. Because Peace and Freedom Party, came out in the late 60s, and the early 70s, and the sort of the anti-war movement and the Black Panther Party and the rise of the Black Liberation Movement, and they got ballot status, and now they keep it, which is very hard to do. If you want to get on the ballot in California, you essentially have to go get like 1 million petition signed.
Yeah.
That's what you really have to do, which means you either have millions of dollars or you have a lot of people, because the state, usually disqualifies half your petitions. So I think you need 350,000 to qualify. So you would really have to get twice that plus some to even get on the ballot. But Peace and Freedom Party's there, and they managed to stay there out of a lot of organizing and mobilizing. And they're socialists. They're open socialists. And so I ran for insurance commissioner, demanding that we abolish the insurance companies and that Medicare for all or health care for all, right? Which are actually, perfectly feasible under a capitalist system, but I did it as an open socialist. And we got hundreds of thousands of votes across the state. I was working both times, working full time as a teacher. So if I had it to do again, I would love to do it without having to work full time. It would have been amazing. We could have gone so many places with the campaign.
Yeah.
But in my experience, the campaign is such an incredible tool to talk to working people.
I voted for you, Natalie.
Thank you. You go places you can't normally go. They talk to you because you're the candidate. And then when you say something that's refreshing, they respond and they sign up and they get interested. And every single talk was about, yes, this is good, but we also have to fight for these things. And so I think that was, it's big. I also ran for Congress in 2008.
That's right.
That was fun.
I forgot to mention
California State Congress or
the federal Congress. Okay. Yeah, I ran against Jackie Speier. That was actually great. That, because you get the health insurance commissioner, we're talking about health insurance. Congress, you can talk about everything. And the debate there is so limited. What you're supposed to say as a candidate is like the lines are so narrow. And when you start talking about like full rights for all immigrants and the wars, bring the troops home,
open borders.
Yeah, everything. You can just see their faces kind of crack. Like, you are not supposed to say those things. And it's great. They need to hear those things. So, that was fascinating.
But overall, you would say that was a good experience for you?
I think personally, it was really hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard to do.
Yeah.
I think what I think was good about it is that you do sort of, you can talk in places that you don't normally get to talk in. Because like if I go to, if I just walk up to like UC Berkeley and say, hey, I'm a socialist, let's talk. People are like, okay, but you don't have a space. But if you say I'm running for Congress or I'm running for insurance commissioner, then you're on a panel and then you get to talk to people. And I feel like that was the best part of it, was being able to access those spaces. And you can even crash them because you can be like, I'm a candidate. Why aren't I on the space? And then say, hey, and this Saturday we're having this demonstration and you all should be there. Like that kind of, like really bringing the struggle into an arena that is devoid of it. I think is a pretty incredible experience just to like see it happen. I think on a personal level, it's hard.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
Other than, maybe not working during that time. Is there anything politically or based on that experience that you would say, if I did this again, I would do it. Any differences you would make work?
Yeah, I think there's always room for improvement. I mean, I think I would like to write a whole lot more the next time that I get to do a campaign and just really break into the politics of it. Because when you're working and you're raising kids, you don't have time always to like really look into it. And I felt like, some of the they seem like minor points, but people ask about them. So yeah. Like the question of car insurance, I would have had like to have a more expanded answer on that. Or the, you know, like you start to get into those political details, which people are thinking about and they want to hear an answer on. And I think I do that better is sort of develop those more.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned about running. Some socialists would say, because I've spoken with a few other socialists, and they would say that it isn't very revolutionary to run as a candidate under a broken capitalist system. And if I remember correctly, you told me once we were together around some lovely cake that you had baked. It was delicious, as all your cakes are.
Thank you. Not all of them.
You had told me once that even voting for Jill Stein at that time as the alternative, because Bernie Sanders had lost in 2016, was trusting too much in the system. Mm. Why run at all under a capitalist system as a candidate?
Right. Well, I think that you have to approach each election asking yourself that question, right? Because you understand that the elections aren't a revolutionary process, that revolutionary change in the United States is not going to come about because of the electoral arena. I mean, there are measures in place to make sure that doesn't happen. There's the ballot access, there's the electoral college itself. I mean, there's so many reasons that the elections don't even offer sort of a possibility of change. So it is hard to sort of say then, okay, well then why do you participate then, right? But I do think there's an answer to that question. Because you think about it, it's like, even now, I mean, the 2020 elections are more than a year away, and we're already months into the campaign.
Yeah.
They're dominating. They're dominating, not necessarily people's minds, but they're always there in people's faces, and they're dominating the political debate in so many different ways. If you have an opportunity to be in that debate and be there, why wouldn't you do it? Like, why wouldn't you try and reach out to the millions of people that do look at the elections? I mean, the United States, like, the electoral participation is low, right? I mean, it's somewhere around, like, the 40%,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the
40s. Below 50.
Yeah, it's below 50. But there's a lot of people in the United States. So even if you have 40% of the electorate participating, that is millions and millions of people that are participating in this and that are looking at it, thinking about it, talking about it. And as a socialist, you want to be there. You want to be there saying, this is a fundamentally corrupt system. And here's why. And here's what we can win. If you're not always tuned into this and you join us and you struggle with us and you talk about what's going on in the detention camps and you talk about the teacher strikes and how important they are. And for some people, they may have no idea, not the detention camps, because at this point, everyone knows what's happening there. But they may have no idea about different elements of the struggle that are like critical to the communities fighting them. And you bring that into the elections, and then you say, and when November 2020 happens, that is not the end all and be all, right? It's like the next day, we're going to keep fighting. And we're not going to be, you know, and you say that. And I think you bring a completely different perspective. And we're not in the type of, I don't think we're in the type of political period where participating in the elections might damage the struggle, or it might, you know, it might undermine us in some way. That might happen. There might be a point at which we say, yeah, you can't, we shouldn't participate in the elections for this, this, and this reason. But I don't think that's where we're at right now. I think where we're at right now is the elections dominate the political discourse. You can intervene in them in a socialist and radical way without ever undermining your principles.
Mm.
I mean, you don't have to, you know, you run, you do your best. I mean, that's what we did in 2016. We only got on a certain number of states. We did what we could. We got out there.
Gloria La Riva.
Yeah, we talked about socialism. We met enormous amounts of people. They came in. They came into the struggle. I think that's a plus, you know? And I think there's another sort of flip side to it that is, if you are making that decision and you're saying, well, I am too radical to go into the elections, I'm not going to touch them because I'm so radical, then where have you left yourself? Like, who are you speaking to about your radical politics? You know, maybe you are speaking to your community. Maybe you are engaged in a particular struggle, but can you also do the elections? Why not, right?
essentially you think that you would do something similar like the Bolsheviks when they went into the elections to hijack the system?
Right.
Is that similar to
periods in which the Bolsheviks absolutely participated. There was like one election in the revolutionary period they didn't participate in, and it was because the revolution was already clearly won on the side of the Soviets. Like, you know, like they participated even in the most reactionary situations. I mean, the Duma into which the Bolsheviks went the Congress today is limited in its powers, but the Duma then was extremely limited and in a very reactionary political context, and they still participated. So yeah, a lot of that relates to, like, you know, the historical understanding that the Lenin laid out and what is to be done, and to other places about really understanding where you're interacting with the working class. And you don't sort of just throw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of the elections, even though you understand they're reactionary.
Mm. Andy, do you have a question?
Maybe let's transition to the school. Mm-hmm. We're both school teachers, or you were a school teacher, but now you're a librarian, but we're both in the public school system here.
And it's a teaching position.
Yes, right. And yeah, I got a second credential to do it. Yeah. You're a member of our union, United Educators of San Francisco. What do you see in terms of being the PSL, being a socialist, what do you see as critical about being a teacher, or in terms of how does it inform your work that you do at your site?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot lately, so I may not have a well-formulated answer. I mean, I think that when I first became a teacher, I took, you know, I'm going to get it wrong, but there's that old prescription about, like, if you don't have a union, fight to make a union. If you do have a union, fight to make a fight.
Right.
And I always thought that was, like, so short, but so poignant in a way. And I feel that about the union. Like, I have another friend who's in a totally different union, and he's his rep, and he always says to his coworkers, the union is you. Like, you are what the union is, what you make of it, because it is a workers' organization. And I've been at sites where our union is less strong than other sites, and those sites always have way more problems. Where our union is strong, the site is strong, and the students have better learning conditions, and we have better teaching conditions. And also, as members, I think we learn a lot. I just feel that way. I mean, I just switched sites, so I'm in my second year at a site, and the union had to do a lot last year. We had a really sort of tough environment. I don't want to go into all the crazy details, but it was difficult, and you could see members kind of learning about their own power as the union sort of brought us all forward through it.
And are you talking about the operation of your UBC?
She
means not our UESF leadership, but the union people who are union activists at your school site.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I was getting to the larger thing, but I think at the site where you have union representation and you have a committee.
Which you're a union rep.
Yeah. And where that committee is strong, that site is stronger, right?
Yeah.
And so that's really a powerful process that I've learned a lot about. And having been an organizer and a socialist, I feel like what that brings into union is a real understanding of how organizations work. And like how you bring the struggle in, and you try and bring yourselves as a group, as workers, together and really unify and build your own strength. And I feel like I learned that not necessarily through the union, but more through the sort of struggle and organization of being in a party and understanding what collective leadership looks like and how you build it. And I feel like that's sort of informed my own sort of participation in the union site. I think for the larger union, for the United Educators, that second part is really, of what I said at the beginning, is really important. You fight to make a union fight. And you also understand that your union struggle is always a compromise. Like, you're always compromising in the union struggle because the bosses want one thing and you as workers want a totally different thing. And you're sort of constantly negotiating over where that's going to end up. And I think the more we're organized, the more people at each site are participating, the more we're going to the assembly meetings, the more we're really engaged, then the stronger our union can be in that struggle. And we're coming up on one, which is why I said that, is I think, you know, the teachers, it's so challenging. Like, all our younger teachers are thinking about where they can live, they're living far away, they're commuting. Anyone who has kids is moving out of the city and then commuting with small children. It's like, it's so challenging. So I do think we need to fight for more in a city that has so much money. And they know it. Like, they're throwing at us left and right. But they need to do it in a way that's substantial and organized and respond to the needs that the union puts out. And I think that the more we can be sort of vocal and engaged in that process, I think the better.
And do you have any specific or maybe not specific goals for our union coming in this contract round?
Yes.
June 30th, 2020, I guess, coming up,
it's
right?
Coming up.
So do you have any specific goals for our, that you would put before our union that you're, that you think we should be organizing around or fighting for?
Yeah, I think that there's a couple of things that we've started fighting on that I think are important. We need to keep fighting on, like our healthcare contribution, which we made some dents in the last one. I think it's huge. I mean, when I had my first kid, my healthcare contribution went from $300 to $700 because I added a third person, and that was taken out of a paycheck with no maternity leave.
Right.
Because we didn't have anything when I had my first kid. So I think that's the second one, is that question of maternity leave and sick leave. And, right? But also, I think the paraprofessionals really need sort of center stage in the next contract struggle. I do think they're the least paid. They don't have full-time contracts. So they have 5 weeks out of the year. They don't get paid at all. I just feel like, and I feel like they're often sort of treated as sort of side work, like, you know, they don't get the respect they deserve. And I do feel like if that could be a real central part of our struggle, I think that would be really good. I think teachers do need higher pay. We all recognize that. But I think our paras really need equity.
We have a massive inequality in our union.
Extremely.
Yeah.
And I do think that's critical. And you know, a lot of them are, especially like the paraprofessionals I've met in the different schools I've worked at, they're longtime San Francisco residents. They have families here. They've made a sort of incredible go at building a life with much less resources. And I do think that, you know, this should be recognized.
So those would be pretty big gains. We would.
Yeah, they'd be huge.
What about the prospect of striking in order to make that happen?
Yeah. I think it's hard to tell because I'm at a site and the last year we were so busy at our site with all the things going on that we didn't get out to the assembly meetings as much as we wanted. So I wouldn't say this from the perspective of someone who's like really knows, but I do feel sort of from an outsider perspective that we've made great gains in organizing. Like, I do feel like I see more people I don't know who are UBC representatives. I feel like more schools have more organizers at them. I feel like there's a lot of lessons that we can learn from the Oakland strike and from the other strikes that have happened about how to organize a strike. So I do feel like organizationally we're in a better position than I thought we were in previous ones. But I think it would be up to what happens in the next year.
Okay.
Like, how well can we organize the schools on the west side of the city? You know, like, they're not as well organized. They don't have as strong UBCs or consciousness. I think teachers have struggled with their consciousness of workers. I think it's really hard for them. They think of themselves as professionals. They used to be well paid. They used to have easier jobs. You know, it's not true anymore. There's been a speed up in education. And I think people are starting to understand that they have to organize and they have to strike sometimes to gain anything.
And that they're members of the working class, not some professional certificate,
right.
Somebody different than other workers.
Or just fighting for better wages because we go to school as much as the other people,
right?
And I do think there's a shift happening with teachers, and you can see it. I also think our communities are very supportive of us. I think we found that the parents and the students, when they come together with the teachers, it's so strong. So I do think if we're able to sort of tap into the community and really organize, I think it could be effective. But I do think when you think about a strike, you do have to think about where your organization's at, right? You have to be ready to take that on. And I think that's challenging. So I do think in the next year there has to be a lot of assessment made. People have to be right. I mean, we went out to the picket lines with I took my kids. We went to the Oakland teachers, and after that first week, rent was due, and you could see the teachers start to be really concerned about what was going to happen because your rent is due and you don't have your rent unless you've figured it out, unless your union's really supporting you. So I do think we need to figure that out and make sure that people feel confident. You know.
Well, I guess this is where I feel recently has been an exciting time when you see a lot of movements in Russia, in Puerto Rico, in Hong Kong, in where else? And I saw in Sudan. What is going on? What is the? What do you think is attributing to this sort of militancy protest movement?
Well, there's also four very different places. So, like, let's just take two, for example. Like, Puerto Rico, I think, you know, it's kind of incredible what happened and what the people were able to do. But it's a lot of what we've been talking about. It's a real crisis. It's a crisis in Puerto Rico, especially of colonialism, of, you know, they're occupied territory. And because of that, the standard of living is also much lower. But then capitalism just rips everyone to shreds, right? And so having been hit by natural disasters that they never recovered from, then to have, you know, the governor being so disgusting meant people, they fought back. They you know, they resisted and they made things happen, as people always do. And I think some of the most incredible stories were about the women leading those protests and that protest movement.
Even in Sudan.
Sudan too, right? It was really incredible. So I think that there is definitely a level of resistance to imperialism and to colonialism. I'm not really colonialism anyway, it's imperialism at this stage. That is incredible. I think the Hong Kong protests are different, and we might not agree on this, so we'll see. But, you know, the Hong Kong protests, there is a level to which, in Hong Kong, which is capitalist and which the standard of living has dropped. I mean, people are just frustrated. There's a current of that within the current protests about people, especially young people's just like anger about their situation. But there's also, you know, a very sort of important history about the relationship between China and Hong Kong and the character of the leadership of the protests in Hong Kong, which has been funded by the United States, funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, which carries British colonial flags in its protests, which is talking about the mainlanders in a racist way. So they're using racist caricatures of the people in the mainland. You know, so the way it's portrayed in the US media is very favorable. You know, the great Hong Kong protests, they're resisting. The police have run out of tear gas. I mean, the police ran out of tear gas, or they used a lot of tear gas and rubber bullets. How many months into the protest? Like 2.5, almost 3? That would never happen in the U.S. In the U.S., the police run out of rubber bullets and tear gas in 2 days. And then they shot someone within a week. I mean, you know, they're talking about the evil Hong Kong police who are actually being pretty hands-off about the situation. I think the sort of historical relationship between Hong Kong being colonized by the British, I mean, I don't know if this is like, I'm sort of giving it a brushstroke, but, you know, Hong Kong was taken from China as part of the wars because China wouldn't open to opium. British colonialists were opening up China, and they were the aggressors. They attacked China because China refused to let them bring in a product that would destroy the population, and did, you know? And then they colonized it, and they didn't give it back. And so after the Chinese Revolution, they maintained capitalism in Hong Kong, you know, and there was eventually a returning of Hong Kong, but the Chinese government had to like operate very judiciously in how Hong Kong came back into the Chinese system. And they've allowed capitalism to stay, and it's ruining the conditions for people there. And now there's these protests being lauded by the US government and the US corporate media as this incredible resistance. And I think so that's why I picked those two, is because I think they show us a very different character. I think that there are elements in the Hong Kong protests that need to be recognized about people's real, you know, resistance to the conditions they're living in. But the leadership of those protests are oriented towards the West. They're oriented toward the imperialists, towards Britain and the United States. They're funded and they're sort of inculcated by them. Whereas in Puerto Rico, they are not. It's a totally different situation. And I think some of the other, you know, in Sudan, I think that's the same, you know, it's a real resistance to a situation that was set up by the imperialists, that has divided Sudan, that has kept its people, you know, oppressed and deprived of resources which should be theirs. So I just think there. But you asked why.
Well, Well, you're giving
I don't
us
know
context.
If I guessed the why.
You're mm-hmm. giving us context. I think that that's maybe the different elements to the differences in protests and why I think that that's important.
Yeah.
And I do agree that the movements are, particularly the leadership of those movements in China are not independent. Yeah. Probably would say that there's a real lack of independence, even though in the Puerto Rican struggle and the Sudan struggle, where the local bourgeoisie has found ways of leading them. But I do think people, the United States is making a big deal and using the, as best they can, using the process in Hong Kong to undermine the Chinese in the region. And it's a geopolitical fight between the United States and China.
It's like a tool in what has become an intense war drive against China.
Right.
As opposed to like, you know, and I think that happens. There are different places you can see the U.S. where the U.S. or in the world where the U.S. suddenly becomes very concerned about a people,
right.
whereas they have destroyed Iraq, they've destroyed Afghanistan, they've destroyed Syria, they've destroyed Libya. You know, like the list of places
right.
the U.S. government has completely ripped apart goes on and on. So they don't really have any concern for the people in Hong Kong.
And this one is Carlos from the Excelsior District, and I chose the Excelsior District because you're very familiar with that district.
I am familiar with that district.
In San Francisco, he asks, I don't see how socialism could work. Look at Venezuela going in crisis. Venezuela hasn't even had a change in leadership. Hugo Chavez stayed in power from 1999 to 2013, then transferred power to Nicolas Maduro. That doesn't sound like democracy. That sounds like a dictatorship. North Korea exploits their workers by exporting them to be used by other countries and their wages given back to the North Korean government. And I did see a documentary that I was given the link to. They aren't allowed to travel outside of North Korea. The state controls everything and actively spies on its citizens using a vast surveillance and informer network. North Korea's media is tightly controlled. Reporters Without Borders, RSF, ranks it last in its World Press Freedom Index. Citizens can be sent to prison for viewing, reading, or listening to content provided by international media outlets. Everything is dictated from their leisurely activities to their personal attire and even haircut choices. Cuba had another dictator run the country from 1959 to 2011. That is 52 years. Then transferred power over to his brother. That's called nepotism. Not real democracy. The list goes on. China, Nicaragua, Soviet Union, Russia. What do you have to say about the failure of socialism in those countries?
I have a question, which is where do you get your news sources from? Because that was painful. I don't even know where to start. Seriously. Each one of those can
Carlos,
be...
Carlos, here's your response.
Yeah, Carlos, here's your response. Each one of that list can be refuted wholeheartedly. I mean, I think you can go through, but one thing I want to say before I go through that list is if you take out the words North Korea and you put in the words United States, then I think you're closer to reality. Really. I mean, who spies on its citizens? The United States. I mean, they're collecting enormous amounts of metadata. And when people criticize socialist countries, they do this a lot. They say, over there, it looks like this, but they don't talk about what's going on here. So that's the first issue that I have with anyone in the United States making those kind of criticisms of countries who have trying to build socialism without resources, completely surrounded by the United States. Let's take North Korea first. North Korea is half of an entire country, and on its border used to sit 40,000 troops, and now sits 20,000 troops, U.S. troops, on their border, right there, waiting to attack them. In that instance, what choice do they have in terms of developing their society if your enemy, which has never, ever ended the war against you since 1953, in which they demolished, they flattened the country, completely flattened it. It was gone. And they rebuilt it under a socialist society in a place where everyone has housing, healthcare, education, and food. And this whole thing about them not having food is like absolute nonsense. Complete nonsense. In fact, we sent a delegation there. And what they came back and showed us was housing, healthcare, food, and cultural activities that are unmatched in the United States. The experience of art that the children there got to have at their after-school program blew away our after-school programs. It was like, for a teacher, watching that was like out of this world. So it's like you don't take the propaganda of the U.S. media and make it your own to attack socialist countries unless you are really here in the movement here doing it. And once you're in the movement here, you don't do that. So Carlos needs to join the movement. He needs to be with us in the streets and in the struggle, and he's invited to be, and we can have these arguments more. But also really needs to look at it. Cuba was not a dictatorship the way he has described it. Venezuela certainly isn't. I mean, they had, even in that space, what, 1999 to 2002, they had 11 election events. Huge. In which they rewrote the constitution to have one of the most progressive constitutions in the side of the world, where they recognize the rights of indigenous people, of women, of the LGBTQ community. I mean, we actually have a constitution at home. My daughter likes to flip through it. It's like this big. It's incredible what they did. And they fought for it. Maduro was also elected. Those were elections, not elections like happens here. Elections where you have the day off from work and you go and you participate them. And even Jimmy Carter, former president, was like, these are the most fair elections I've seen. I mean, he has his organization that guaranteed them, but he personally went too and said, the way these elections are run, it is a model for other countries.
Hey, can I press you on something, Natalie, of course, just for, because I did have this conversation with Carlos. If it cuts off, it cuts off.
Okay.
This is a conversation.
Carlos will get his full answer if it cuts off.
Just because I speak with the listeners, and mm-hmm. I pressed Andy lots of times last week. I pressed him very heavily. I speak with them. Come, get out of the way. You still cannot argue, though, for North Korea when they dictate, they give you, what, 27 forms of haircuts that you can have that we are not allowed, that they're not allowed to have other than those specific haircuts. And we don't even have a list of haircuts here that we can choose. Would you not say that there are still differences that that North Korea and the USA have?
You mean in terms of quote-unquote freedom or?
Quote-unquote freedom.
Okay.
With some difference of freedom.
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is like the analysis, the fundamental analysis, not the details. I actually don't know anything about the 27 forms of haircuts, and I need to see where it comes from, because so much of the news generated here is false. It's fundamentally false. Like, every month we have a meeting where we go through the capitalist media. We read an article from the capitalist media.
Uh-huh.
And when you sit down and in a group you read it, you see how many lies you can find in just one article on one particular subject. Because the U.S. corporate media has a picture that it wants to paint. It doesn't talk about the demilitarized zone. It doesn't talk about the history of Korea. It doesn't talk about all of, that's why I raised all those things.
Yeah.
And yet, there are definitely, no doubt, there are things in all the places that were mentioned that are not ideal. Absolutely. I'm not going to say that any one of those societies has hit the like perfect notch on everything, right? They're in North Korea. To be honest, I don't know about the haircut thing. But like, there are things I'm sure that people would say, yeah, we don't like this here. We don't want to have this. We don't want to live that way.
Or North Koreans can't eat. North Koreans cannot even travel outside of North Korea.
Yeah.
Whereas we can.
But why? Why can't they? That's the question. Why can't they?
You tell me.
I'm asking is like, we can travel, yes, but they have 20,000 troops on their border. The state is in constant peril. They're on the list for the largest imperialist country in the world has them in its sights. How are they going to organize a completely free society when their society is constantly threatened? And that's why I say why. Because it's like, yeah, we can travel, but this society isn't threatened at all. And if the United States government felt threatened, they would shut it down.
Well, it is also true that when the United States even thinks they're going to go to war someplace or thinks somebody's going to attack them, they pull people out. They say, you can't travel there. We have travel bans. We've done the same things all the time.
This is true. We do have a travel ban.
Look at Israel. They won't even let Tlaibin. They won't let Ilhan Omar. They won't let anyone in because they're, you know, they don't want people to see the reality in Israel. And Israel's always held up as a democracy in the Middle East. It's not a democracy, it's an apartheid system in which an entire indigenous population isn't allowed to participate at the pain of prison and death. I mean, like, that's why I said, like, why? It's like, we can't just sort of hold one freedom up to another freedom and say they aren't equal. We have to look at what is going on what freedoms do we not have in the United States that we should be talking about? We do not have the freedom to access healthcare. We do not, you know, like, if you can't get it, you die. You don't have the right to, the freedom to have a place to live, the freedom, you know, those are big things. They do have those things.
Out there. And Jonathan, you're asking, Natalie, can you give us some examples of where socialism has worked in history?
So places on that list actually would be among my examples. I don't think socialism working means it has to have done perfectly, that every single box needs to be checked or it failed. And we don't hold capitalism to the same standards. It's already failed us, right? But if you look at the gains that were made for the majority of people in different places where there has been a socialist revolution and socialism was constructed. So if you look at the history of the Soviet Union, even in China, which I think has a lot of contradictions today, which a lot of it's like a whole nother episode, right, to like talk about China. But there were many gains made in China. Cuba, I think, is an excellent example, especially because of Cuba's size, how small it is. I think it's been able to do things that maybe the Soviet Union wasn't able to do. But also because of its participation in the socialist camp, it got a lot out of that, right? I mean, there's a lot. But if you look at it, like, I'll just take the Soviet Union, even though it doesn't exist. You could go with Cuba, you could go to a lot of them. But both. Soviet Union was able to, women voted before they ever voted in the United States. They had the right to vote. They had the right to abortion. They had the right to divorce before they ever had it in the United States. So just those small gains for women, which were huge at that time. I mean, the revolution happened in 1917. Within a year, they had fundamentally changed the legal status of oppressed people in the country. I mean, there were, you know, languages that became the official languages of the schools. And we're still fighting in San Francisco right now to have immersion actually be like continue so that Spanish and English can be taught together and Spanish can be honored. The entire Soviet Union had, if you were an autonomous region, your language was the primary language. That's what was taught in schools. That's what was honored. That's what culture was honored. The changes that were made in terms of people's access to healthcare and education. I mean, if you look at what's happened since the Soviet Union was overthrown, the people's living conditions has dropped drastically. It's incredible. I mean, the death rate is higher than the birth rate. People are suffering because everything that was collective and provided was sold off, and now it's private. So I do think that socialism worked in the Soviet Union. I also think that 14 armies invaded it within the first year.
Oh.
Yeah. That it was always surrounded, that it was always in peril, and it was always at war. And I don't think socialism flourishes when you're at war. I really think socialism needs peace to really flourish, to be able to expand, and to be able to develop into what it could be. But there were many, many gains that were made. And some of those were also rolled back as the leadership became more right-wing. I think Cuba is another example. Healthcare, education, housing, those are rights. Those are not rights we enjoy. Those are rights that, even when they're won, they're not rolled back. Like, that's what happens to us, right? Under capitalism, you win something. Like, Roe v. Wade's a great example because we're writing about it in the magazine. There's a lot of struggle going on it, but the people won Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court decision was not like some, you know, those rich white men deciding that, hey, you should have the right to abortion. It was based on the struggle. And then within a year, they were chipping away at it. And now most women don't have the right to abortion. They don't have access to it because of the chipping away at it, right? Under socialism, it's not like that. I mean, it exists. It's there. And the government is really run in the interest of the people, of working people. So it's been successful. But Jonathan and I could also talk more about that. He could also, you know, organize with us.
Thank you. Let's wrap up. So this is a very, just to finalize, what do you think then we need to do to make a revolutionary transformation here in the USA?
that's a big question.
You only get one sentence.
I only get one sentence. I think we have to keep fighting. No, I mean, I think, you know,
other than the campaigns, what should we be doing here in the USA?
I think we organize. I mean, I think we, you know, all over this country, people are capable of making great change. But they're only capable of it when they come together. I think that's the answer. You have to come together. I think that, you know, there has to be a movement. There has to be a movement that is ready to take up whatever issue. I mean, climate change is a huge crisis. The movement isn't strong enough on that. The issue of racism and police brutality is a huge crisis. The movement needs to be stronger on that, right? A movement that, when you come together, like we were talking about how I even got political, that's how you learn. When you get out there and you organize, you learn to do things you didn't know how to do before, and then you bring other people in with you. And I think that's critical, because we need millions of people in the United States to decide that what we have right now is not okay, and that there's an alternative, and that they're committed to organizing for that alternative. And that's what we need. We need to convince people of the necessity of socialism and the ability to organize and to struggle for it. And I think that's the basis for a revolutionary transformation. I think all the other things, like if you think about the historical challenges of any other revolution, in Russia, in China, in Nicaragua, in Vietnam, in all of the places that have had some sort of revolution, it was that they didn't have the capacity to do what they needed to do. Economically, productively, it just didn't, even socially, it didn't exist. People weren't trained. The majority of people in this country have gone to college. The majority of them have some training. You know, we wouldn't need to rely on anyone else to run the society in a different way. We wouldn't have to, you know, we don't have to make that argument. We don't have to build factories out of nothing like the Soviet Union did. You know, we wouldn't have to increase production out of nothing. It all exists there. What we really need to do is convince people of the necessity of it, and they're already convinced of the crisis of it. They don't need convincing of that. People know how hard it is to live. They need the convincing of what's out there, what's the alternative. I think that's our step, the movement and the convincing.
Toward socialism.
Yeah, of course.
And I can't, somehow I've heard this attributed to Rosa Luxemburg, but I think it was Engels who said, the choice before us is either barbarism or socialism. Right?
Yeah.
First of all, would you agree that that's the choice before us?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And what do you, for you, what do you feel about the prospects of whether we're going to get socialism or barbarism?
Yeah.
Because honestly, if I was to bet right now, I bet on barbarism. Mm. I'm a socialist. I feel like we have to organize for that. But I feel like our situation on the left is weak. I don't believe that there's this new socialist movement. I'm not encouraged by what's happening around Bernie Sanders. What about you? You know, because that's something that each person who's a revolutionary kind of takes
right.
the temperature of whether they think it's likely or unlikely. It doesn't change. We have to organize.
Right.
But what's your own thoughts about that?
I think that is a tough question. I mean, I think I always, I mean, I go back to this like four times in the last month, but I'm going to do it again anyway. You know, it was what the revolution that happened in Russia, the February Revolution. I think it was the first week of January that Lenin said, I'm not going to see revolution in my lifetime. So he literally, a month before the revolution started, and yeah, it took a while to really understand it was a socialist revolution, but not many left, not that long, a couple months. But you know, in a month before, Lenin, who was this like on the ground constant socialist, was questioning whether it was viable. And so I have a hard time sort of trusting my own personal feelings about it, or my own, you know, my own, because you do get demoralized sometimes.
Yeah.
You're like, dude, I can't deal with it anymore. I can't watch another video of another cop killing someone. I can't watch these videos, you know, the pictures of the kids in the camps. It's like you think of your own kids, you know, like you feel like, how are we going to fight this? But I think you have to think back to, that's what other people thought too, and then they had successful revolutions. And I think that's what I always come back to, is like the historical examples are there, and the prospects are here. Like, people are interested in socialism. They are open to talking about it. They are open to an alternative in a way I don't think we've seen in a very long time. And I think, you know, I think this is like my 18th or 19th year organizing at this point. I mean, it's been a while since people have been this open. So I do think the prospects are out there, and I think the possibility exists. And so as socialists, we have to argue for that. I do feel that's important. I think we are, I don't think, Engels meant a certain thing when he said barbarism. It's like such a weird word because we don't use that word. And, you know, but I think if you think about it as utter crises, and extreme poverty, and extreme racism, and sexism, and sort of, you know, then we are living in it. We are living in it, and the only option is socialism. Like, that's how I like to think of it, is like, how are we going to face this? And the way we're going to face it is by having socialism, by fighting for it, and by making it a reality. And I think that we have to make it real for people. It can't be just like some like thing that could happen in the future. It has to be like, what would you really, under a socialist society, how would it transform your life, you know? And I think for people, I'll just use a personal example, but as a mother, socialism is necessary for us. We don't have childcare. We don't have universal preschool. Our kids go to school and they get off at 3 p.m. We don't work till 3 p.m. We don't have health care for them. We don't have, you know, we struggle as an individual burden to provide them food, housing, all these things that under socialism would be organized so differently, right? I mean, I wouldn't have to cook all the meals for my kids on Sunday so we can make it through the week because I work. We would have cafeterias where people receive a wage to provide that for everyone collectively, and you would go with other families and meet with them and have socialization that you don't have right now. We're all sort of alienated from each other. So I think we need to talk about it in that terms. What does it really mean, what we're saying we want to fight for? It means a real transformation, just not of like how we produce things, but like how we interact with each other and how we view our responsibility as a society. And I think that's big. I think that's winning.
Win, win, win.
Yes, we can win.
That reminds me of some actor that always said, winning. There is a really? YouTube video. Anyhow, I'm just we are speaking with Natalie Risi, a socialist, active organizer of the Party for Socialism and Liberation, writing contributor for the Liberation newspaper of the PSL, and former teacher, now a librarian at James Lick Middle School, no?
Mm-hmm.
And union representative for UESF and former candidate for the California Commission of Insurance in 2014 and 2018, editor of Breaking the Chains. Thank you for being here, Natalie.
Thank
Gracias.
You.
I've been wanting her here for, a year?
Yeah, he's been talking
about it.
You were the first on the list when you said.
When we were talking about interviews, I said, Natalie.
It's been a while.
So, thank
can
you.
Can we do a plug for the magazine as part of
yeah,
the wrapping
yes.
up? Yes. Do you want me to do it right now?
Please.
Sorry I interrupted
yeah.
you.
Yes.
Well, I just want people to check out the magazine, because Breaking the Chains just came out with a new issue, and it's on the struggle for reproductive justice.
And
so
we have a link
huge.
We can provide for it?
Yeah. Breakthechainsmag.com, and we have a Patreon even, which is crazy. But yeah. People should check it out.
And what's happening for this? Just a protest as well that you want.
Yeah.
To say.
So this is a coalition of folks coming out of the mission that wanted to hold on Mexican Independence Day on September 16th a demonstration to close the camps. And you know, really, what else do they say? It's really important, actually. So they're demanding amnesty and full rights for all, to end ICE, to abolish ICE, and to close the detention centers and no more raids. And I think we'll be meeting at 11 a.m. at 24th and Mission, and there'll be a march, and that is midday, but there is an activity in the late afternoon and evening that everyone can join if they're not able to take work off that day. Just come out to 24th and Mission. There'll be a whole fair.
And there will also be a link for that in our
yes.
video description.
Great,
we will
great. That would be fantastic.
Thank you, Natalie,
thanks,
for being here.
Thank
and
you.
Thank you for our listeners and viewers. You can find us on our 5 platforms on Stitcher, iTunes Podcast, Google Play, BitChute, and YouTube. Please rate, review, subscribe, and best of all, share with your community. Thank you for listening.